Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, folks. Welcome back to the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4 in Midtown Kansas City in the old Ice House building. It's been remodeled into some lofts and other businesses, kind of a cool old building. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
We're also here with my good friend and guest tonight, Troy Cole. Say hello, Troy.
Hi, Gary.
So we are back again for our fourth and maybe final episode, I'm not sure, I think it probably will be, of the Robert Berdella serial killer investigation. Troy Cole was the sergeant in charge of that investigation and lived and breathed this thing for, I don't know how long, 6 months or so, I believe, Troy.
At least 30 years.
Yeah, you're still living and breathing it, aren't you?
Still living it.
Still won't let you go, will they? Yeah. Well, and Troy has a book out. Buy the book. Help him get a little money out of this. You know, he did get paid for his time at the time, but, you know, it wasn't enough. There's not enough money to pay most of you guys to walk into that house with the dog shit all over the place and the decayed and spoiled food and old skull that's only been there a few months and a dead and a skull with a hair still attached out in the backyard and a whole lot of other stinky, smelly, horrible, awful, nightmare-inducing things. How much would it cost you to pay somebody to go do that? I don't know if there's enough money. Some people, my wife wouldn't do it. You couldn't give her enough money.
Probably pretty hard to get some of those images, you know, like the skull from the backyard out of your mind, yeah, let alone some of the Polaroid photographs that you found.
You can't unring those bells, can you, Troy?
No, the police chief, he used to come to us every few days, and he'd say, "Now, Troy, is all the detectives okay? You guys okay? You're seeing some pretty gory stuff now. If anybody needs to see it and have some counseling, we'll make it available."
Of course, no, of course, right. I know cops. We're men. Yeah. We don't need no help. We don't need no stinking help. We're men.
And if we did, if we wouldn't dare say it.
We sure as hell wouldn't tell you, Chief, or any of our coworkers. We'd tell our wives or our girlfriends, maybe. Well, we might even sneak out and go to a counselor now and then. I sure did, but we sure as hell wouldn't tell you.
Your counselor wasn't Jack Daniels.
Yeah, your counselor mainly was Jack Daniels back then, wasn't it?
That's true.
Now, you need to go out and get the book, Rites of Burial, by Tom Jackman and Troy Cole, who was the sergeant and the detective for the murder. It was called the Berdella Squad. Which was he supervised a squad of 11 detectives assigned to investigate the Berdella case.
So where are we at, Troy? We were, Aaron, do you remember?
I think where we were at, what we had done, we had identified that there was, in fact, one actual murder.
Oh, yeah, Robert Sheldon.
Because you could place the skull with the actual person, right?
Right, you had the teeth and you got the dental records.
We got him identified through dental records, and he turned out he was a kind of a drifter from California, and nobody had reported him missing. His family hadn't seen him in like 6 years, but again, he was the type of guy that they didn't keep track of. But we did charge Berdella with his murder. And
did you ever figure out how he came into contact with Berdella?
We only found that out
in his confession.
After Berdella decided to confess.
Okay, we'll get on in that confession a little bit. So you now continue to look at trying to figure out who the rest of these other five.
Yeah.
You kind of know Jerry.
Well, there was more than five we were trying to identify.
Six.
There was about 20-something people because we didn't
that
know
were
who
missing.
We didn't know who was dead or who was alive.
Okay.
But there was about 20 different individuals. Steve Worland. He spent hours at the crime lab, and he kind of posed the photographs due to scars and birthmarks, because some photographs you'd have a facial picture, and others you might have nothing but, you know, from the waist down or something. So anyway, he was able to categorize a lot of photographs, and as it turned out, we had about 21, 22 people in the photographs, different people that we needed to identify.
Okay, so then you start trying to run them down and find out if any of them are totally missing and find out what they knew.
Yes, if they're alive, we need to find out what they knew, what occurred at the house, and if they weren't found, then were they one of the two skulls, or were they dead?
So you started finding them, it sounds like.
We did start finding some of them.
Once you put the pictures out in the newspaper, you really started getting a lot of tips.
That's when we generated we got the most interest, and we wound up, basically, we wound up identifying all of them through the media, the rest of them through the media that we hadn't identified.
So you identify like 22 different people, of which then you were able to actually find that how many of those were alive?
All but six.
All but six. And those folks, when you show them, like they could maybe tell some background because they appeared in the photo, as far as maybe who the other people were, whether they were somebody that was alive or one of the six that you couldn't find alive.
Yeah, we got leads on them. And again, through these interviews, we wound up identifying, I don't know what the number was, but we wound up identifying most of them at that point. And again, we had charged Berdella with murder at that point. And you want to go into when he was arraigned in court?
Did you have everybody identified when you had that preliminary hearing?
No.
Where he wanted, okay.
We didn't get everybody identified until probably 6-8 weeks into the investigation, probably, before we got the last one identified.
Okay, but now, folks, the legal kind of process, you first charge somebody with a warrant. You find the probable cause. You have enough information to give to a judge who issue a warrant, so they charge them formally with, in this case, murder. Set a bond or no bond, a real high bond. And then several weeks after the initial charge, they have what they call the preliminary hearing. And at the preliminary hearing, the judge then will maybe take evidence to say you want to say there's no probable cause for this warrant. They'll challenge the probable cause, or maybe there was a bad search warrant and all the evidence that was being used to charge this person was out of that search warrant, and they'll challenge the validity of the search warrant. For example, they'll say, well, you didn't name your informant in here, and we have to know who the informant is, for example. That would be one kind of legal technicality, which won't work, but that's something that's been tried. And so you have a preliminary hearing a few weeks later with Robert Berdella, and he's been charged with the murder of Mr. Sheldon, Robert Sheldon.
Yes.
And so what happened at that preliminary hearing?
Well, again, most preliminary hearings, they're kind of a formality. That you don't call all your witnesses. You usually have one representative from the police department that shows up, and he testifies just general knowledge enough to show that there's probable cause to take this case to trial. In this case, when we went to the preliminary hearing, Berdella, the judge, one of the formalities is the judge says, Mr. Berdella, how do you plead? Berdella said, guilty. And everybody jaw dropped. It's just something that doesn't happen, especially with a murder case. And to make a long story short, the reason that he had pled guilty, he wanted to avoid the death penalty, and he was afraid that we were building up a good enough case to give him the death penalty. Well, in order for the death penalty to be imposed, there has to be paperwork presented to the judge saying that we are going to go for the death penalty in regards to this case.
Correct. You'd have to have notice.
You
have to give notice to the defendant and to the judge.
Correct.
To the court that this is going to be a capital crime case, and so that will give the defense time to start preparing for a death penalty case.
Yes, and in this case, the prosecutor's office had not presented that paperwork because they didn't expect him to plead guilty, and they assumed that later on they would present the paperwork to go for the death penalty.
So this was kind of like a legal maneuver to try to avoid the death penalty and just say and hope the government would go ahead and take the life sentence which would be imposed.
Exactly.
And then maybe the government would just quit after that.
Exactly.
And he'd have life. Who were his lawyers at the time? Did he have public defenders?
He had public defenders. He had Pat Berrigan, Barbara Schenkenberg, And then later he had Charlie Rogers were the three people that represented him from one at one point or another.
Okay.
But you only really had one body to be able to convict him for a murder. Would it be standard to try to go for a death penalty on one murder?
Well, for a death penalty, I could answer a little bit of that. For a death penalty, you have to have certain circumstances. There's a list of about, what, seven. It might be 5 or 10 special circumstances.
Regarding the nature of the crime.
A particularly horrendous crime. A law enforcement officer was a victim, or a couple of them.
Yes.
To get the death, to even ask for the death penalty. So this would be a special circumstance, and it was a crime of a particularly horrendous nature.
Yes.
But you really hadn't even uncovered the whole nature of the crime yet.
No, we hadn't.
You're in a preliminary hearing.
And that's why it was such a shock that he would enter a guilty plea.
So what did the prosecutor do? Were they able to just say, well, wait a minute, we want a continuance?
Yeah, that's exactly what they did. Pat was obviously taken by surprise. And
then he springs up out of his chair and says, Your Honor.
So he approached the judge and asked for a continuance.
State wants a continuance.
Yeah, and from that point, there was a lot of legal wrangling that was taking place. I wasn't privy to it. I wasn't even at the preliminary hearing. But anyway, it was a way for Berdella, to make a long story short, it was a way for him to avoid the death penalty, at least on this one particular case. And so that was his reasoning for making the guilty plea.
So they sent him on back to his jail cell, and you got a continuance, and the prosecutor probably then filed the paperwork that said this is going to be a death penalty case.
I think that probably happened within the coming days, yeah.
Right, and you guys all kept working on trying to identify the other victims.
Our job was to continue working and trying to identify other victims and make other murder cases if there was cases to be made.
Do you remember anything about identifying those victims? Any stories about that? I mean, how it kind of came to pass on particular any individual victims?
Well, we had Mark Wallace was the next victim who, as it turned out, some of this didn't come about until Berdella's confession. So I'm kind of getting ahead of myself.
Oh,
well, wait a second. So what you really had, though, as far as evidence and what you're bringing forward for the murder at all, was it was Robert Sheldon, because you had his skull, which you found in the closet.
Right.
And made a dental record match, I'm assuming, then from that. And then you had the skull that you found in the garden outside, out back of Bob Berdella's house, which was Larry Wayne Pearson. Now, had you identified that was, in fact, Larry Wayne Pearson?
At the time that we arraigned Berdella on Robert Sheldon's murder, no, we had not identified Larry. Larry's identification came about, and again, I'm not sure of the time frame, but it was several weeks into the investigation before we got him identified. We basically, and the way he was identified, we found a police report in which Berdella had claimed he had gone to the hospital with a bite to his penis. And he had made a police report, and he said that the suspect was Larry Person, P-E-R-S-O-N. Well, we tried to find a Larry Person, and we couldn't find any such animal. One of the detectives did some digging and found out that Larry Person was really Larry Pearson. So we find a GOS, a general ordinance summons, in which they take a fingerprint when you're charged with a little misdemeanor. They take a fingerprint, put it on the back of the general ordinance summons. So we find a fingerprint that matched him. Let me think a minute.
Matched Larry Wayne Pearson.
So at that point, we're thinking, okay, Larry Pearson is probably the suspect who bit him rather than Larry Person. Mm-hmm. So our goal then is to locate Larry Pearson. We find out that he had been in and out of prison. Last known address was in Wichita, Kansas. So I sent two detectives to Wichita to try to locate him. They find some relatives of his in Wichita. They show the relatives' photographs of people being tortured, the stack of photographs of people being tortured. They picked out several of those pictures and said, that's Larry Pearson. So now we know Larry is probably one of our torture logs, or possibly is. Because the pictures that they identified, you could tell this guy had been tortured for a long period of time. Actually, he looked like he'd been in a concentration camp. Pictures when he was first captured, he looked like an Olympic swimmer, probably 6'1", 190 pounds, well-built. The last pictures that Berdella took of him, he looked like he'd been in a concentration camp and had probably lost 50 to 75 pounds. Basically, he was just a skeleton. But anyway, we got him identified.
You're able to do that because at that point with family members, you can track back to like a dental record and you have that skull from the garden.
We asked the people in Wichita, do you have any dental records? One of the families was able to go to a dentist in Wichita and said, yeah, we got. So anyway, we bring the records up. And Dr. Ronald Geyer, who did all of our comparisons, identified his dental records as being the head that we've dug up out of the backyard. So now we've got another potential murder case that we can file regarding Larry Pearson.
So you got two bodies.
Even though what you have really is Polaroid photographs, people knowing that Larry was alive and then having him disappear for some time and then finding his head in the backyard of Bob Berdella's house.
Yes.
So now you keep working on these guys, but during this time then, at what point in time did...
How long was the continuance?
I don't recall, but the prosecutors were in and out of court doing some stuff. I wasn't really privy to it. Well, some of it involved... trying to sell Berdella's house and trying to confiscate his house, basically, so he couldn't sell it and use the money to make bonds. So there was a lot of legal wrangling that took place that I personally didn't have any involvement in it.
But you were at the same time, were continuing the investigation. You had essentially identified out of the 22 different people appearing in the photo in the Polaroid photographs, everybody except for six people. Is that correct?
Correct.
Plus, the continuance doesn't really matter. They could get maybe only a two-week continuance, and you'd come back and say, well, we need more time because we're building our case. Because all they have to do is then file that document that says they're going for a capital crime. And so then get that filed, and you're home free, and you set a trial date a year from now. And so you've got all that time now to continue to investigate.
Correct.
And they can't, they're not taking a, he's not going to give you a guilty plea for a death penalty case.
Death crime, no.
Would he have done, would they have taken that? They probably would have.
I don't know.
Beat a cop to a death penalty case. I don't think they would have taken it.
I don't think
But wasn't it sort of in this time in between that preliminary hearing and then you identify Larry Wayne Pearson after subsequently, right?
Yes.
It wasn't before that preliminary hearing. And then you have a list of other people that were missing who turned out to be Bob Berdella's victims. Now, I guess Bob comes into the preliminary and he basically says, hey, I'm guilty. He's hoping they're going to just take it right to court, charge him, and then he'll go to jail.
Send him to prison for life with no parole, right?
It'd be the simplest, safest thing for him not to delve further into what could be a larger crime.
That's his goal, yes.
So now there's... You're continuing to work on it, and you're maybe even finding some of these kids or figuring out who they are, but you still don't have any kind of other evidence to link Berdella. You've found no other physical evidence to link Berdella to any of these other boys during these next few months. You didn't have anything.
Well, once we got the others, we eventually identified six people who became murder victims.
The victims.
Yeah, the people that we know. We had you had identified Robert Sheldon.
At that point, we had identified Robert Sheldon and Larry Pearson, and we got the other, as far as physical evidence, that's the only two we had. But we got all the other people who turned out to be homicide victims, we got them identified through the photographs.
And those people included Jerry Howell.
They included Todd Stoops, James Ferris, Mark Wallace, and Jerry Howell, yes.
So now, at some point in time, they've got the sodomy case coming up. You've got, Berdella's got at least one charge of murder. You know you can make a second charge of murder against him because you've got two bodies that you can link to him. But how did this work where he then decided to make the deal? I think we're to that point in time, unless you can think of something else that's kind of interesting that people would like to know about.
No, we got all the people identified over the course of, again, 8 to 10 weeks probably, something like that, 2 months. We got them all identified. We got the Sheldon case filed. We're going to file the case on Larry Pearson. And all of a sudden, Pat Berrigan, who was his defense attorney, contacts Pat Hall and said, need to talk to you. So he went to him with a plea. He said, my client's willing to plead guilty if you won't go for the death penalty, because at that point, Berrigan knew we were getting ready to hit him with another murder charge and that he would go for the death penalty on that one. So he goes to him and says, like a workout a deal, he'll plead guilty to every murder he's committed if you'll give him life with no parole. He'll tell you what happened to the victims and how he killed them and how he disposed of their bodies. So at that point, it became a decision for the prosecutor's office, basically. Do they want to take this? Do they need to talk to the families of the ones that we had identified up to that point and find out, you know, are they willing to go along with it? Are they going to fight this thing?
I would imagine Paul Howell, Jerry Howell's dad, would not go along with that because he had already attacked Burdella in a court hearing.
He attacked him at the arraignment.
At the arraignment.
Yeah. He was going to kill him. He took a gun. He had a pistol. And he went over to the courthouse on the morning of the arraignment. And to his surprise, there was a
metal detector
set up.
And they were kind of new back then.
It was new. Huh. And he didn't expect that. So he went back to his car and put the gun in his car. Then he walked into the courtroom and immediately jumped over the rail and started beating him up. And he was not. He was not for the plea. But as it turned out, Pat Hall and the other attorneys, they had to decide whether or not to accept this.
I suppose Albert Reeder, he was the prosecutor at the time.
Obviously, his
final decision, because it was a politically kind of.
They were getting ready to have the election.
Sensitive decision, you know, and everybody wanted to see Bob Burdella fry.
And the election was within a few weeks.
Oh, really?
So, uh-huh.
Interesting, all these different things that figure into it.
Because Carol Coe was running against him.
Carol Coe got into this
somehow.
Carol
got into it. She got on TV and said this, he's turning this into a political ploy. She injected a lot that added fuel to the fire, so to speak.
If you're not from Kansas City, you won't know that name, Carol Coe. But Carol Coe was a lawyer who I think eventually became disbarred and was quite a character in the city and was in the news all the time. She represented Gilbert Dowdy, a big-time drug dealer, and screwed that all up. He ended up going to jail for about 50 years, and he just got out recently. I don't know if you saw that, but Gilbert Dowdy just got out. But these people don't care about that. They never heard of Gilbert Dowdy. But Carol Coe then tried to make – she's going to run for prosecutor, and she did try to make political hay out of this whole Burdella
decision. She went out to Burdella's house and had a press conference on the steps and said the police have bungled this and the prosecutors have bungled this. So that was another angle that we had to deal with.
The politics of it all. But so, I mean, here you are in a situation where what you really know you have is a couple, two murders and a sodomy, where you know that's. And when Bob says, hey, I'm willing to come forward and confess, do you think he knew that you didn't have more information? Or do you think he thought maybe these guys might have all these guys'
names?
No,
he knew that we were getting close because his attorney was presenting him with the police reports, so he was able to kind of keep up with the investigation for the most part.
Yeah, like defense has a discovery element there, so they get to see everything
I think he was aware that, we were getting close to being able to.
Closing in. You had the 7 journals at that point?
Yeah, and the reason that we knew that we were starting to put together through the torture logs, Jerry Howell, because Jerry Howell had disappeared on July the 4th. Well, one of the torture logs had the name Howell written at the top of it, and 7/4 of 84.
Oh, wow.
A date. Yeah. And then he starts describing the torture and what he had done to him. So we assumed pretty strongly that he was dead. And then we found another torture log for Ferris with similar notations, and the dates corresponded to the dates he had disappeared. So we were able to feel pretty confident that that's 2 more victims that we knew of. but we didn't know about any more. Those were the only torture logs that we could link to people at that point.
But the prosecutor was getting, I mean, the defense attorney was getting all that information as you guys turned it
yes.
in to the prosecutor's office.
Right.
So that was putting pressure on him big time, wasn't it?
So I think he must have really had a fear of the death penalty in order to...
It seems like he tried that other little legal ploy. You think, I don't think the lawyer, I bet he forced the lawyers to, I bet he told them, the client is the boss.
It was his idea, yeah, I don't
think
it was Bergen's
idea at all. And I bet he told those lawyers, I'm going to, here's my little ploy. I think he's one of these guys that thought he was smarter than everybody, didn't he?
He did. He looked down upon everybody.
Yeah.
He thought he was the catch me out.
So he thought, well, I'll just go in there and plead guilty and they'll just all go away and I'll go down and start serving my life in the penitentiary.
Well, a normal life sentence on a murder case isn't actually life, is it?
Well, this was life with no parole that he was willing to plead to, though.
I mean, when he said I'm
guilty.
Yeah, initially
he was willing to plead to life with no parole.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So there still was no getting out.
Right. He knew he was going to slip. Yeah, he knew he would never get out of prison, but he was just so fearful of the death penalty that he was obviously willing to do it.
Although where there's life, there's always hope.
That's
true. He didn't know. Something might change.
Yeah.
They could change the laws somehow, and he might get a shot to get out.
So then how is it then with the logs, as you tell that you're figuring out Jerry Howell, right?
Yes.
You've got Walter James Ferris, Larry Wayne Pearson. Then how did you come upon Todd Stoops?
Todd Stoops, we had gotten the photographs identified of him because he had lived. Todd Stoops had been married. And he and his wife had lived with Berdella off and on for a period of a year or two. And then they divorced. She moved back to Massachusetts. And Todd basically became a male prostitute in the area. And he was hanging out at Berdella's house off and on for a couple of years. So we had him identified through lots of photographs, being tortured and...
And then being missing.
And being missing, right. And at the end of going back to Jerry Howell's torture log, the very last notation on it said DD86. So obviously we didn't know what that meant until later, but we assumed that meant he 86 was he was dead. Yeah, and yeah.
Troy, do you find it? You were really close to this. Do you find it unusual or strange or hard to explain that like this Todd Stoops, he had been a friend in and around Berdella for 2 years or so, year and a half or, 18 months, 20 months before then all of a sudden Berdella decides that he's going to tie him to a bed and torture him for a while until he dies.
Yeah. He couldn't explain it either.
Okay.
We asked him that question.
Yeah.
And he said, I really can't tell you. Although the more he talked about it with some of the victims, he was mad at him for whatever reason. Jerry Howe, for example, his very first victim, he wanted, the night that he took him captive, he wanted him to drive up to Parkville and look at a used car that he was thinking about buying. And Jerry was somewhat of a shade tree mechanic, so he wanted to go with him and get his opinion on the car. Well, Jerry didn't want to go because he had plans to go to a dance that night. So in Berdella's mind, he's thinking, all this I've done for this guy, and he won't go up. So he got mad and decided, I'm gonna tie him up and torture him.
Wow.
And wound up killing him. Mm-hmm. And with Ferris, he thought Ferris had turned him in. Independence had arrested him arrested Berdella for possession or sale of marijuana, I forget which, a couple of years before. And he suspected that Ferris had been the informant that turned him into the Independence police. So that was his motivation for killing him. So a couple of the other guys, as it turned out, he thought, well, I've treated him good. I've given him room and board, and they do me wrong. And so I decided to kill him.
So none of them, he didn't snatch any of them off the street.
He didn't know. They all went to his house willingly.
Willingly.
Yes.
And most of them he knew for some period of time. I remember reading one of them done yard work around his house for
a while. Yeah, he knew Mark Wallace. That was the one that had done a little yard work. He knew him the least. Mm. And
here, according to Wikipedia, it says they discovered by chance hiding from a thunderstorm in Berdella's tool shed.
Yes. It was a big thunderstorm, and Berdella's dogs were just going crazy. He said they were barking and carrying on. He couldn't get them to shut up. And they were acting like there was something in the backyard. So he goes to the backyard to investigate and looks in his tool shed, and he sees Mark Wallace in there, basically just taking shelter from the rainstorm. So he invites him into the house and goes in and gives him Melton cookies or whatever, whatever it was he gave him. And
tea and crumpets.
Yeah, and at some point within the next couple of hours, he decides to take him captive.
Huh.
So he crushes up some tranquilizers and puts it in a peanut butter sandwich or something, knocks him out, and then from that point he takes him up to the bed and ties him to the bed and eventually tortures him until he's dead.
Now, so you're sitting there in basically in your police in your room. Are you still in the at the Bradella Squad location?
Right.
And Bob basically comes. He's been in court. He said, "Hey, I'm guilty." And now he wants to come forward with a confession.
Yes.
What kind of discussion was there high-ranking levels on the police department? I know that had to go all, at least up to Colonel Jenkins to make that decision. Do we go along with this? What do we say about this?
It did. And Colonel Jenkins, he let me voice my opinion. And I'm sure the chief was probably involved, too.
Although, oh, yeah.
But I know Colonel Jenkins and I talked about it, and we were both in favor of it. Because how much better can you get than life with no parole and finding out what you don't know? You got this big investigation going, but you may never know what happened to three or four or five of these people at this point.
And they've got family out there. Many times family, they just want to know what happened.
Yeah. And we wondered, you know, what do you do with the other bodies? If we got, you know, a head in the closet and a head in the backyard, where's the rest of them? So, yeah. There was a lot we wanted to find out, and the only way to do it was to accept his plea, and eventually that's what we did.
And so what did the prosecutors, what was their reasoning for accepting the plea? Did they have, did you remember the reasoning that they gave or that they
used? I think the same reasoning. I think they felt like we're never going to know unless he tells us. I mean, we might be able to get a conviction on these two murder charges that we're going to hit him with, but, you know, there's... We didn't have, it wasn't a strong case. We still didn't have a cause of death.
You didn't have a cause of death. You didn't have any scientific evidence to link Bradella's hand to their death.
We couldn't say that they didn't die of natural causes and then he cuts their heads off.
And he did something with their bodies. Yeah. So it took a drug overdose, for example. It'd be easy to he could come up with some other little street hustler witness that would say, oh yeah, they overdosed with drugs, and then I helped him cut them up. I mean, you never know what's going to happen.
It wasn't a slam dunk case, and I think that's one of the reasons we were kind of all in favor. You know, let's go. Plus, if we'd had a trial, they had already determined that we were going to have to get a change of venue, and it was just going to be a nightmare type of trial.
Yeah,
it's too widely publicized.
Yeah, we were all in favor, I think, of accepting his plea.
I think I read in your book that Albert Reeder told Jackman probably that when he questioned him about it, that he knew Paul Howe was not going to like it, but he said, "I just have to deal with that."
He dealt with. He had to deal with Paul two or three times, I think.
But I bet he did. I bet he had. I
so
bet.
Did I.
Did you?
Yeah.
It was he.
He came
case.
To see me more than once.
Did he? Even after he accepted the plea, was he didn't come back around after that?
No, during the investigation was. No. When
oh
I,
yeah,
when
I'm
I
sure he did.
It.
I know he had a huge interest in it. He'd already. Been around.
And who wouldn't? I mean, if I'd have been in his shoes, I'd have been doing the same thing.
Yeah.
So now, and, didn't blame him at all.
And Bob, in this instance, going to come forward with a confession, didn't want to just do it there in a police headquarters in a room in a, with you and another officer as witness?
Yeah, what was the, how was that set up?
Because that's not how it ended up.
The way it was agreed upon is Pat Hall and Berrigan. They got together, and Berrigan said, here's one of the stipulations. There's only going to be one copy of this transcript made of his confession, and the public defender's office is going to keep it. Well, Pat Hall said, that ain't going to happen.
No.
So they wrangled over that, I think, for a day or two, and then it was finally agreed upon that, you know, there would be more than that one copy made. It was determined by, again, the two attorneys that the interrogation would take place in the county jail, and that there would be two defense attorneys present, two from the prosecutor's office and two from the police department, and that's all. And then a stenographer or a court reporter. So that's how we did it. We had a room up on the sixth floor of the Jackson County Jail, and it was right off the medical unit where Bob was being housed, and we met with him and spent 3 days with him, And
wow, 3 days.
3 days, three long days.
He didn't tape record it.
Did not. It was just a
stenographer.
Court reporter took the notes. And it was agreed upon that instead of having a whole bunch of questions going back and forth, that there would only be one person asking the questions, and that we all got together and presented our questions to him prior to sitting down.
Who asked the questions?
Pat Hall did all the questioning. And,
but he actually got to review the questions before he answered them.
Yes.
Or him and his defense attorneys.
You mean defense?
The defense attorneys for Bob would actually probably look at you. You would, you know, go through because you had all this voluminous amount of material from the case.
No, the defense attorney.
And where there was actually kind of holes, and when you're trying to fill in the thing, wouldn't be that be the area where you'd just say, well, what about Jerry Howell?
Defense attorneys didn't. They hardly objected at all. The flow of questioning went really good. It wasn't like a court where I object and hey, my client's not going to. There wasn't any of that. It was all forthcoming with no issues, and the questions were not presented to the defense attorneys ahead of time, to my knowledge. I don't think they were. Can't be sure of that, though.
Was there anything particularly shocked you about? I know you're pretty well hardened all this by now. You've seen all the pictures.
Everything about it shocked me, Gary. It was
during the confession, I guess. I don't know. That had been hard to sit through that.
It was hard to hear a person describe what and how he did all this torture. It's almost inhuman. I mean, you try to think, how could a guy do this? How could one human being do this to another? I'd been in homicide. I worked a lot of murders, but nothing even close to this.
And when you got a confession from a murderer before, they had some emotion about it, too. Yeah, and they, you know, it was, but how was he?
He was very calm. He enjoyed it. I don't think there's any doubt that it was like he was reliving the whole thing again. It wasn't like he tried to hold back on anything. It was, but the amount of torture, the types of torture that we didn't know about. I mean, from the photographs, we knew there was some pretty bad stuff that took place. I mean, we had photographs where he'd have a finger stuck down halfway into an eyeball socket. So we knew there was some bad stuff, but it turned out to be a whole lot worse than what we had ever dreamed. Mm-hmm.
But you were actually one of the, there was two officers and you were one of them.
Yes, myself and Detective Al DeVolcanier were the two from the police department. And then it was Pat Hall and Albert Reeder from the prosecutor's office, and then Burdella's attorneys.
And it was like 8 or 10 hour long sessions for 3 days.
We started about 8:30 or 9 o'clock in the morning, and we'd go till about 5 in the afternoon, and we had 3 full days.
Did you break for lunch?
We did break for lunch, about 30, 45 minutes.
Could you eat anything? Sitting there listening to this description.
Pat Hall got sick. He actually had to take a break and go to the bathroom and throw up. He was just, it really got to him. Mm-hmm. And Pat died, God rest his soul. He died in 1992 at age 41 of a heart attack. Wow. And I have no doubt that this case added greatly to his early demise. Mm-hmm. He took the case, to heart and lived and breathed it. And so
I remember reading about this and knowing you, I thought, God, Troy, how did you sit through this?
Yeah, you'd kind of walk out numb at the end of each day.
Yeah.
It's like, wow. I mean, I just, and to hear him describe it so nonchalantly, I think that added to
that. That would make it.
And some of these bodies, most of them, as a matter of fact, if he killed them, let's say, in the early evening hours, he would take them up to, he would either take them to the basement and cut them up, or he would take them to a third floor bathtub and cut them up. And he'd cut them up and leave them up there for 2 days. He'd sometimes take 2 and 3 days to dismember them and put them out to the trash. And I'm thinking to myself, how can you walk back in there that second or third day with that scene in front of you? I don't know how you do that. I don't know how any human being could do it.
Wasn't that part of, I mean, when he did that, he had to let himself, and he was a large man, drag these bodies, corpses, up to the third floor because he was draining the blood out of them and leaving them in the bathtub, right? Cutting them in like at the points where the blood would settle.
He did, although before, usually with most of the victims, when the person was getting close to death or he knew he was getting ready to kill them, he would take them up to the third floor before he killed them That way he wouldn't have to drag dead weight from the second floor to the third floor.
Or the basement.
Or down to the basement. So he would get them, in position a little bit ahead of time. And
so, you know, I guess most importantly, in a way, and did you already tell Mr. Howell about what happened to Jerry?
Albert Reeder did.
Albert Reeder did.
Yes, Albert had a meeting, a private meeting with the Ferris family and the Howell family over in his office. I was not part of the meeting, but he explained the details to him.
Did that transcript ever get released at all?
Not to my knowledge.
Is it?
I've never seen it.
No one's ever. It became a piece of a sealed record.
If it's out there, I couldn't tell you where to find it.
If it was out there in anything but totally secure hands, it would have been on the internet by now. Yeah, if it gets out at all, it's out on the internet.
Yeah, so what you're saying is some of this stuff is not even available for Freedom Information Act requests.
You know, that's a good question.
I don't know.
Because that would make another great book for Gary Jenkins.
Do you want to go file a lawsuit and see if you can get him to up that transcript? No, I don't want to do that.
Just
I'm not doing that book. Troy's already written the book.
I think the thing that...
Just the transcript. Yeah, all I'd have to do is just put binders on it and sell it. You could, too. There's a lot of people out there that would buy that thing.
I bet
one of the things in his confession I think that probably stick with me the most is... Each victim, he kept them and tortured them longer and longer. And you wonder, you know.
So he was getting more pleasure out of it.
Oh, yeah.
It was
so you wonder
escalating.
How long he would have kept Chris Bryson before,
yeah, really.
You know. He kept him 5 days. And if he hadn't escaped, because he went from 2 days with Jerry Howell, and the next guy was 2 or 3 days, and then 4 or 5 days. And then by the time he got down to Todd Stoops, who was the fifth victim, he kept Todd a little over 2 weeks. And then Larry Pearson, who was the last victim, he kept him 43 days.
43 days.
43 days. That's the guy who looked like
he'd
been in a...
That's the one that was emaciated.
Yeah, he'd been in a concentration camp.
Wow.
So you wonder what Chris Bryson would have dealt with.
Chris Bryson dodged a bullet, didn't he, when he jumped out of that?
Yeah. I came across him at a murder scene not long after that.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a murder over on the east side of a drug house, and he was there.
He was alive, though.
Yeah, yeah.
He's probably still around somewhere.
I don't know.
Now,
we'll have to try to find him.
In all of this, I mean, you're nailing down the cases that are the easiest, I would think, to charge on, which would be the ones where you have physical evidence to kind of pair up, then with Bob's confession. Were there other, you know, when did you walk away from this wondering if there weren't more people
I didn't.
He just was not telling you about?
A lot of people did, but I didn't. To listen to him describe what he did, and you could tell that he enjoyed talking about it. If there had been more victims, he would have gladly told us. He had no more punishment coming. You couldn't do any more to him punishment-wise.
So that was the deal. The deal was he
could confess to 50 more and it wouldn't
more.
Have mattered. Yeah. Yeah.
I guess the only other thing would have been maybe if they were in another state, he might not have confessed to him, but... You didn't have any kind of inkling that he had done anything like this anyplace else but right here in Kansas City.
Well, he'd lived in Kansas City for
his whole life,
25, 30 years. He moved here
since he was
right out of high school. Yeah,
from Ohio.
Came here for the Art Institute.
So that's right. He was an Art
Institute. He had been living on Charlotte Street for 20, 22 years, something like that.
Okay.
And so, I have no doubt that if he had killed 10 or 15 more, he would have gladly told us about it.
Did he explain, and I know you guys ask him, why did he do the torture logs? What was his reasoning?
He couldn't give an answer. I asked him that particular question. I had Pat ask him that question, and he really couldn't give an answer other than it was like kind of like playing doctor. Because what he would do is, you know how doctors know you go to a bedside and you look at you know, how they'll scribble 3 cc's of this and whatever. And he said, I guess I was kind of like, in a perverted way, playing doctor. And in addition to torturing them, some of the victims, when they would start to really go downhill and get a bad infection or something, he'd inject penicillin in them to try to make them better. So it was one of those up-and-down things.
He was kind of like one of those Nazi doctors, Dr. Mengele. He was doing human experimentation, wasn't he? With the drugs and what the effect was, because he was making notes about what the effect of so many cc's of a certain drug was.
If a drug made the guy snore, he'd write, 11:30 p.m. snoring, and then... If he was fighting his restraints, he would make a notation, 2:30 a.m., fighting restraints. And,
Had you heard of anything like this anywhere else in the United States? I don't think
he's
I have.
He's a little bit unique in the fact that most serial killers, the number log. One, they kill their victims right away, usually within the first 24 hours.
Yeah.
And most of them don't keep torture logs on them. So he's a little bit unique in that sense. And we interviewed some psychiatrists, psychologists, and they reviewed some of the case file, and they thought he was kind of unique in that aspect too, so...
You know, I kind of think one last thing about the occult kind of aspect of this. I know Geraldo Rivera came to Kansas City and did a show and kind of indicated that there was some kind of occult connections, that maybe there was other people, maybe he was part of some witch's coven or warlock's coven, or and I know there were some local cops that were involved in investigation of occult things, and so with that... What would you say about that? It probably got in your way more than it helped of any kind, but I don't really know.
Yeah, it did. It was there were some detectives, a couple in particular, who wanted to bring that and make it a part of the investigation. I really had no interest in it. I mean, all I wanted to do was solve a murder and identify these victims, determine how they were killed, and if the occult was part of it, fine, and if not, who cares?
So if there were other people involved in some organization, but you weren't finding any kind of evidence at all.
There was absolutely no evidence.
And, of course, in Berdella's confession, he would have gladly talked about that, it sounds like.
And he said there was absolutely none of it. But, yeah, there was people. There was a Geraldo came in, and he wanted to do an interview with me. I told him to hit the door. I had no interest in talking to him about the occult. So he got real mad, and he kind of blasted me on his TV show.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
I wonder if we could find that TV show. I'd like to see that.
We need to get a clip of that. Here's the thing. You can't really put somebody in prison for worshiping the devil.
Yeah. No. Right? This is the United States. We have freedom of religion
freedom
here.
Freedom of religion. It's not really, you know, a chargeable offense.
Yeah. I guess what I'm thinking of is I know some of those policemen, and I know that they want to see a conspiracy. And they would love to bring some kind of a conspiracy of a lot of people in.
Yeah.
And I never did see it.
No, it wasn't there.
In any manner, really solid evidence of any kind of conspiracy of people who are members of the occult that are involved in any kind of satanic rituals or where people are killed or virgins are sacrificed or anything.
Geraldo,
I never could find it.
Geraldo got two or three people to say, oh, yeah, I was at an event where Berdella did this to, you know, I forget now exactly what it was. But anyway, she was putting Berdella at the scene and doing all these.
And some kind of ritualistic killing or something.
And,
yeah.
We asked Berdella later. He said, I never seen that lady. I have no idea who she is and what she's talking about. So we wound up poo-pooing the whole thing.
There could have been quite a few people who were kind of following the case who wanted to glom on to the media attention.
Could be. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. In a case
including
like this.
Including Geraldo.
Yeah. The nuts come out of the woodwork on a case
they
like
really
this,
do.
Don't they, Troy?
Yeah, they really do. We had reporters in here from the New York Times, Chicago Tribune. I mean, it was kind of a night. That was one of the worst parts of the investigation, was having to deal with those people. And because I mean, you're kind of limited as to what you can tell them. But, you know, they're still here, and they want an interview, and they, you know. So.
What about false confessions? Did you have much, any false confessions or anybody that wanted to implicate themselves in this?
No. No, nothing even close.
Did you ever get a chance to go back and read the book that Bob Berdella claims influenced him called The Collector by John Fowles?
I never did read it. I know what it's about, basically. He kept girls in a tool shed or something, as I recall.
About a man who abducts young women and holds her captive in his basement.
Yeah, no, I've never read it, and Berdella's kind of wishy-washy on that. I think at one time he said that book or that movie maybe had a little influence on him, but then there was another time he kind of poo-pooed that, so I'm not sure.
What is it you think that really motivated Bob Berdella to do this stuff?
I think, his first victim basically... Jerry Howell, according to him, and again, I'm going to have to kind of go with his word, Jerry died basically, Berdella didn't intend to kill Jerry. He had injected him with so much drugs and kept a gag in his mouth that he basically died. He did die, but Berdella didn't intentionally go up and put a bag over his head and choke him like he did some of the victims.
And that was his first?
That was his first one.
So do you think maybe he found that?
I think he got some enjoyment out of dismembering that body and disposing of it and all that, because he said when he found out that Jerry was dead, he said, now I got to, what am I going to do with the body? So he said, I pondered that for several hours, and he thought, well, the only way I got to dispose of it and dismember him and dispose of it that way. So he drug him down to the basement he's the one that was hanging upside down by his heels.
In the photograph that looked like
he photographed it. So I think at that point, I think he enjoyed it. And again, with each victim, he kept them longer and longer. So I think it became a thing that he got some enjoyment out of.
But even though he sexually assaulted them, as he had them bound and gagged and they were alive, there was no indication that he assaulted them after they were dead.
He said he didn't, right, after death, right.
I would think that would be a question people would ask.
Yeah.
Not that there's a charge for that, is there?
He was asked that, and he denied it.
Well, obviously, folks, what they need to do, if they're listening to this podcast from Gangland Wire with Troy Cole, is go out and get the book, Rites of Burial, that was written in part by Tom Jackman and Troy Cole, who was the supervising sergeant for the Burdella Squad. You can find your book. You said it's on Amazon?
There's used copies. Uh-huh. No new copies left. But
no new copies?
No new copies.
See, that thing came out in 1992.
Yeah, it's been out for quite a while.
They did a second printing, and then it was published over in Great Britain, I think about 2000, 2001 maybe.
So they don't even on Amazon UK?
I haven't been to.
But you could probably find, if you went out on Amazon.
I guess the question would be, do you get any royalties from Amazon?
Yes.
You're still getting some. So they've still got some new copies that they're...
Not from Amazon. Oh. I'm sorry. No, not from Amazon.
But from Kindle, which most people now...
Kindle.
They get their book out.
Kindle. That's why Kindle. There's no more printed copies. Right. There are Kindles out. Kindle. Oh, I see what you mean. Okay, I got you.
Kindle just bought the rights to it maybe two or three years ago.
So see, it's an evergreen product. It'll probably pay you till you die a little bit. You may be getting like 5 cents a month.
I probably can't go to the Bahamas on it.
Who was that policeman? Dave Stafford. We had that little bit part in that movie the day after, and he talked about how he gets a check about it every so often for 10 cents or 15 cents.
Well, I get a little more than that, but not much.
Well, the book itself, 365 pages with an acknowledgement at the end, also includes some great photographs, including the skull found in one of Bob Burdella's closets that was later identified as the skull of Robert Sheldon. If you want to, you certainly could see these photos, or some of them may appear online, but what you really want to do is get the book from the man who worked the case.
That's
Troy
it.
Troy Cole.
You got to buy the book. All right. I think we pretty well finished this with you, Troy. I may try to find some other people. I got this psychologist dude up in Illinois that be willing to talk about it, to put together a whole program. And maybe, we're trying to find Paul Howe.
I think I might have a lead on
him. He's got
Paul
a lead
Howe
on him. And
through a friend of mine.
I'm trying to find Paul Howe. He probably would come and talk.
And we'd like to find Chris Bryson as well.
Yeah, that would be a good one.
Reed Malloy was one of the psychologists. I don't know if he's a psychologist or psychiatrist, but he's kind of a well-known, nationally known psychiatrist or psychologist who helped us on it. You know, he did some...
He's from Kansas City.
Well, I don't know, but he's not from Kansas City. But anyway, he gave his opinion and was familiar with the investigation. Yeah.
You know, another thing that didn't really have anything to do with it, didn't you tell me that you guys got a hold of Joe Wambaugh when you first started writing this true crime book?
I talked to Joe.
He helped you out quite a little bit. Was kind of what you're expecting, what you run into, the pitfalls and the traps you might run into, and the way to market these things, and who to get as a publisher.
Yes, the main information was, you know, how do you get started?
Yeah.
And his best advice, he said, the best advice I can give you is hire a literary agent. And we did.
You were able to find one? And
found one in Massachusetts. And
Which by with Tom Jackman already being an established reporter.
Yeah.
Because a lot of those agents, they wouldn't like talk to me.
Yeah.
If I'd call them up and say, hey, I'm writing a book,
yeah,
they'd say, well, what have you done before? But yeah, you had Tom Jackman. That would have been.
Tom was.
He would have been.
He was the driving force.
Yeah, he would have got
you into
that.
It was his idea to do it. I had no interest in it.
Yeah.
And he bugged me for months and months. And finally I said, you know, if you can get the Board of Police Commissioners to agree to it, I will.
Yeah.
But I was pretty hesitant. And,
you can't really break ranks there. It's a kind of a code of silence, isn't it?
Yeah. And I wouldn't have done another one.
You know, I heard you say that before. You would never do another one.
It was a lot of work, yeah.
Yeah.
But Tom did. He did most of the work. I got to give him his props.
Well, and the outcome for Bob Berdella, obviously they send him to the Jefferson City Correctional Center, where he serves what would be a life sentence without parole until he dies of a heart attack in 1992.
Yes. Yeah, he had served about 4 years and had a heart attack, had the big one.
Did you get any feedback about what his life was like down there at the penitentiary during that time?
The assistant warden called me, and I don't know why he did, but he had called me one day. I think he had a question about Berdella or something, and he called at the office, and I never met him, but he wanted to know a little bit about Berdella. He said he's the biggest pain in the butt prisoner we got down here.
Oh, really?
He was constantly filing these frivolous lawsuits. I mean, he was just, I don't know how many he filed, but several in the 4 years he was incarcerated. So, yeah, he called to basically complain and tell me, don't send me any more Bob Berdella.
Was he out in general population, or do you know, or is he in segregation?
I don't think so. I think he was in segregation. I think he had too much publicity and notoriety. And
yeah,
he would be a high-profile guy to kill.
Everybody would know who he was. And some of them even would have been, like, you know, more sympathetic with his victims.
Yeah, could have been.
Other people who had been victimized by these chicken hawks or fruit hustlers, or they were fruit hustlers by these chicken hawks.
So at this point, though, they pretty much have disbanded the Berdella squad, and you yourself, Troy, you go back to the homicide squad?
The everyday rigors of homicide, yeah. killings. No,
you were way behind schedule, probably, because, I mean, if you were 6 months or 8 months working the Berdella case, there had probably been almost 100 more homicides in the city.
I wasn't away that long. I think I was away for between 3 and 4 months, probably, as I recall.
Totally away. And then probably still had to handle some Berdella things, but you had a full caseload besides
stuff
that.
Coming in on it.
So that actually wasn't even your only case at the time.
Well, it was. During that 3 month period, I didn't work anything but the Berdella case.
And neither did any of your guys. You had 11 guys that didn't work anything.
We all.
So the other homicide people had to double up on their cases for that period of time.
Yeah, they probably weren't real happy with us.
They were waiting for you until you get back.
You get the high profile case, though.
Yeah, you get all the notoriety. You get your name in the paper.
At that time, I would have gladly given it to anybody that wanted it, let me tell you.
You were still wishing it was a sex crime, so Roy Arthur would be in charge of
Where's
this.
Where's Roy?
Where's Roy?
Then you retired in 1996?
Last day of 1996,
Then he went to work as an insurance investigator for several years, and now he's totally retired. I know a little bit about Troy, traveling the country in his RV.
We're so lucky to get you here.
You actually got rid of that. I remember you said that.
Yeah.
We're really lucky just to get you here because you have, other than your book, there isn't a lot of places where people could find where you have come forward and spoken about this.
No.
Without the court records or the, you know, confessions and stuff that you really can't hardly get.
I mean, try to just let this case die.
He wouldn't have been here if it wasn't for our history together, would you, Troy?
That's
true. I do appreciate it.
Turns out the case has a life of its own.
Yeah, it does. It just seems to never go away.
Does it surprise you, the interest that people have in something like this?
Yes.
And the fascination.
Do
people still contact you and go, well, I think that maybe this other missing person was one of his victims?
No, I don't get that. But I get probably 4 to 6 requests a year to come do a talk somewhere.
Oh, really?
Or do a dog and pony show somewhere, yeah.
They offered any money to do
that? No, I haven't been paid. Most of them I turned down.
I can get a little money for a dog and pony show. Mostly they want it for free, and I'll sell my DVD.
Yeah, I try to if it's not somebody I know, I don't deal with it anymore.
Was that a kind of, in your career, probably a high water mark, if you will? There was no other cases that you handled that were quite as...
No, I never worked another case that got this
much publicity
or...
And you were fine with that?
Attention. Yeah, most of the murder cases you work, you're with them for a few days and you either solve them or run out of leads or whatever. But no, I've never had one with that much intensity.
Any contact with the Berdella family?
No, we tried to interview his mother. When we first arrested him on the sodomy charge, she came to Kansas City. His dad was dead. He had died of a heart attack several years before. And we tried to interview his mom just to try to get a feel for maybe learn something about him. She wouldn't talk to us, so didn't have any contact. He had a brother, but we never talked to him.
Did you learn anything about his childhood at all, other than his father was an alcoholic? And
he claimed that he was abused physically and emotionally by his father.
What you learned was from him, I guess.
Yes,
everything
that's all.
You learned. You didn't have any independent witnesses or anything.
We interviewed some of his classmates.
Oh, did you?
Uh-huh. High school classmates, and most of them were shocked that he would do this. A couple of them thought he would really go places because he was smart. He finished eighth in his graduating class out of about 400 students.
That was a big school then.
Yeah, and he finished pretty high. So
he obviously had some artistic talent of some kind. Did he draw or paint or what was his medium?
I don't know. I'm not sure what his talent
was. He went to the Art Institute.
Yeah. But he came to the Art Institute and they kicked him out after he did some bizarre things. Hmm. He brought a baby chick one day to class and chopped its head off in front of the students. I mean, he did some bizarre stuff.
Well, you know what they say, people that, an earlier age are abusing animals, look out.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that.
Well, and he did have a criminal record from before, although it was pretty minor stuff. Here, according to Wikipedia, at 19, he was arrested for possession of LSD and marijuana, but was released after 5 days due to lack of evidence.
Right.
And then in 69, he was expelled from college after killing a dog for the sake of art, which would have been the Art Institute.
It was a duck.
A duck.
A duck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And but, yeah, he did some bizarre stuff. But most of his high school classmates, they didn't have anything earth-shattering to say about him. They say, he was kind of a nondescript guy, but nobody had any big stories about him.
His father, it says here, was a die setter at the Ford Motor Company, and his mother was just a homemaker.
Mm-hmm. His dad died when Bob was about, I think he was 19, 20 years old, and his dad had a sudden heart attack.
So there was a history of that in the family. It wasn't necessarily surprising. Bob Berdella was actually on a heart medication. I had read, whether it was here or somewhere else, when he was incarcerated, and had contacted a priest or minister that he was in communication with, saying that they were denying him this heart medication, and then subsequently he died of a heart
attack. Another lawsuit for
that. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if that happened or not, but yeah, he claimed that they wouldn't give him his heart medication when he was...
What about that Roger Coleman dude?
Roger befriended him.
Yeah. Roger, and I've read enough about it to know that he, and I know him a little bit. And
he was a mouthpiece for Berdella, basically.
And he's a pretty genuine altruistic kind of guy. I've talked to him a couple of times. He's kind of a midtown artist here and preacher, kind of a radical preacher, shall we say, and hangs out with artists and musicians and everything. He knew Ben Mead actually pretty well. So did he ever, he just went down and talked to him at the jail?
Yeah, he befriended him, and he felt sorry for Bob, basically.
Yeah.
And here he's charged with all these horrendous crimes, and the newspapers are painting him to be this horrible person, and he's getting all this bad publicity. So Roger went up to kind of console him, I think. Hmm. And he took Berdella's case to the public a couple of times. Berdella would tell him, the police are calling me this and that, and I'm being mistreated, and I'm really not this monster. So Roger would go to the media and speak for him. And I never had any contact with Roger.
It seemed like it would be hard for people to be like, but Roger, he dismembered bodies.
What about that head they dug up in his backyard?
he lured young men for drugs and sex into his home and then tranquilized them before he murdered them.
Well, Roger was just being a good Christian. Yeah. That's what I know about him. Really? He truly was just being a good, thought he was being a good Christian. Really? You know, he thought that you know, Jesus walked among the lepers and the tax collectors and the prostitutes and all that.
Well,
and I think Roger probably thought that's what he was doing.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't doing it with Bob when Bob was released.
No. He wasn't going over to Bob's house for dinner.
No. What about, have you had any communication with the families of the victims at all?
I haven't had any, no. No. A lot of the...
they were pretty disconnected from their nuclear and their families.
You know, Paul was very, you know...
Paul was here. He was here. Connected.
And the Ferris family was here.
Oh, were they?
In Kansas City. Paul Howell, you mean.
But the rest of them were...
They're from around other places, weren't they?
Yeah,
United States.
And most of them hadn't talked to their victims. They hadn't talked to him in years.
Years, yeah.
Yeah. Sheldon, for example, I think was about 6 years since anybody in the family had known him or talked to him. Yeah. And a lot of people thought all this horrendous stuff couldn't have taken place in this house without the neighbors knowing it. And a lot of people had a hard time believing that. And but, you know, when you stop and think about it, he kept all of his victims tied up and drugged up and a gag in their mouth all the time where they couldn't scream. And
they came in voluntarily. He didn't drag them in.
No.
They came in voluntarily, and he shot them up with drugs and got them under control. And then,
and he shot Drano in their throat so they couldn't scream.
Oh,
so,
really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Not on all of them, though, was that?
Not all of them, but at least the last two or three he did. And what gave him the idea to do it is James Ferris, when he was torturing him. James had something wrong with his throat from, I don't know if he had a sore throat. Anyway, he had something. And he noticed that he couldn't scream very loud when he would apply the various tortures to him. So that gave him the thought to, down the road, I'll put Drano in the rest of them, man. And that way they can't scream very loud either. But
I don't know what to say to that one.
Well, he put acid in their eyes, you know, tub caulking in their ears.
What about Chris Bryson? Was there any kind of post with him at all? Or once he was like, okay, we're not really worried about the sodomy charge, so we're not going to pursue anything in terms of that or any storylines, if you will. I mean, kind of the outcomes for somebody.
But there is kind of a storyline about Chris Bryson. They were going to charge Berdella with 7 counts of sodomy. I read this in your book, I believe. And then Bryson didn't really want to testify. And he also was thinking about suing Berdella because he wanted a piece of that house.
Right.
And in the end, Pat Hall, I think, talked Bryson into agreeing to if they would just, we wouldn't have to go to court. They'd get him to cop to one charge of sodomy, but Bryson had to agree to not go after the house.
Is yes. That's pretty accurate, as I recall. We had trouble locating Bryson a lot of times. We were trying to keep
him. He would just drift away. I remember that. You get a victim like that, and come time for court, and you couldn't find him.
And that happened more than once. And so he was not an easy. That was another reason that, you know, you take a guilty plea when you can get it.
Yeah.
And but yeah, we had a lot of trouble locating him. We wound up putting him in a hospital for evaluation and some treatment and. He seemed to be better after that, but then he got back on the stuff. And like I said, the last time I had contact with him, I ran into him at a murder at a drug house. And this was several months or maybe even a year or two after the Berdella case was over. And so I think he was still leading a lifestyle.
The same lifestyle he was back then.
And he was married and had a kid.
Even though he was lucky that he's alive.
Yeah, yeah. But he went through a lot. I got a lot of sympathy for him. I can't imagine what he went through.
Well, if you've got a loved one with a drug or alcohol problem.
Don't go to Bob Berdella.
Do not.
Do not go to Bob Berdella's house. Here's what you do. You make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. Aaron, what do you got to say to that?
I've got to say that you need to buy or rent the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon for rental or purchase.
But do not take it over to Bob Berdella's and watch the movie with him.
No. Also, share, subscribe, and give us a review if you enjoy what we do here at Gangland Wire Crime Stories. We'd like you to go to our iTunes account and give us some stars, five preferably. Right.
Give us a review. Let me know. Email me or contact me, and I'll send you a link to two free previously unpublished podcasts that Aaron and I have done that I'm saving back just as a reward for somebody that gives us a review.
That's right. And if you know Bob Bordella and you're still alive,
you're lucky.
You're lucky. And send an email to ganglandwire@gmail.com. Maybe we'd like to talk with you.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Oh, well. We'll be looking for some of these people, Aaron. All right. That's all I got. You got anything else, Aaron?
Remember to put a hit out on our donate button.
Okay. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Troy.
Goodnight. Have a good one.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Stock them online at Odd-O-Matic Music.com.